From the Sky News Centre at 5, David Cameron and Nick Clegg have started talks on what could become a parliamentary partnership or full coalition government. It's a consequence of the lack of a decisive result in the general election. The Tory leaders made what he calls a big, open and comprehensive offer to the Liberal Democrats. While Gordon Brown is still in the hunt and remains in Downing Street, he says a decision has to be made soon.
People do not like the uncertainty or want it to be prolonged. We live, however, in a parliamentary democracy. The outcome has been delivered by the electorate. It is our responsibility now to make it work for the national good.
Counting went on into the afternoon in some constituencies, but the full picture's now become clear. The Tories have won 306 seats, 20 short of an overall majority, a rise of 97 on the last Parliament. Labour lost 91 overall, taking 258, and the Lib Dems did worse than expected, losing 5 seats. The Electoral Commission's announced an inquiry into why hundreds were unable to vote because of long queues at polling stations. We now know 65% of those eligible to vote did so, a rise of 4% on the last election. The FTSE 100 share index has fallen sharply again today on fears of the Greek economic crisis spreading. It's closed almost 2.5% down. The pound's also taken a hammering against the dollar. City expert Jeremy Beckwith says the city will need some reassurance.
The big fear is that we don't have a government that's strong enough to be able to push through a very credible deficit reduction package. And since that's going to be really very painful for the next 2 or 3 years, you need a government that's you can feel confident it's going to last more than 2 or 3 years. And therefore, we want to see something that has a clear majority, whichever way it is.
Volcanic ash from Iceland again threatening European airspace. New explosions are reaching a much higher level. Some transatlantic flights are being rerouted, with the ash cloud rising to 35,000 feet. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guests to have a look at some of this week's news, but mostly to look at the election results, are Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, John Keeley, and Conservative councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. Also, our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, incredible claims were made last week about the discovery of the 5,000-year-old fossilised remains of Noah's Ark in eastern Turkey. We revisit the Bible story of Noah and the flood and ask, is this the first time the Ark has so-called been discovered? A farmer and founder of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, Anthony Bush, will be here to explain and discuss that and explain his views on creation and evolution. Billy Quain will be here as well after 6 with his What's On guide, and the lovely Marina Morris is back from the Ukraine with a report on her country's political situation. I'll be asking her what the Ukrainian MPs were throwing at each other the other week and why. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but here's first our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, averaging 7 degrees Celsius, a cloudy weekend with rain mainly on Saturday, better weather on Sunday. Next week, averaging 10 degrees Celsius, getting brighter towards the end of the week with sunny spells, rain mainly midweek. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of May, averaging 6 degrees in the daytime, some sunny spells, but wetter on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. So, on to our look through the week's news now, and particularly looking at the local election results. Joining us is Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, John Keeley. Hi, John.
Hello.
Just introduce yourself, John. How long have you been a councillor on Bristol City Council? You're for the Lib Dems, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I've been a councillor for, in total, 22 years for this ward of Easton.
Okay, and you? What about you, Chris Windows? He's joining us too. Chris, you're a councillor for Henbury. How long have you been on Bristol City Council?
Almost as long as John, just since June last year, actually.
Now, it's not been a very good night for the Conservatives, has it? It looks like the Conservatives have lost 2 seats on Bristol City Council.
Yes, that's true, we have. We've lost 2 seats to Labour, I believe.
So what's your explanation for that? Why do you think that Bristol's been bucking locally the national trend?
Well, first of all, I have to say it wasn't my fault. But go on further than that and say it's very, very difficult. Most elections, you start to get the ability to predict fairly accurately what's going to happen. But this particular election has been totally upside down, and I have to confess that I'm completely mystified as to where everything's going.
OK, back to you for a moment then, John, because one of the big shocks has been that even though we had a lot of information in the run-up to the election that Nick Clegg was going to do better, his total number of seats has actually dropped quite considerably in the general election.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things I'd like to say. The first thing is that the Conservatives actually lost three seats on election night in Bristol, not two.
Oh, did they? Sorry.
They've actually lost three, that is correct. Nick, yes, you know, I wouldn't hide from the fact that we were hoping for, you know, a much bigger breakthrough than we got, bearing in mind, you know, the enthusiasm with which people actually embraced us on the campaign trail. But having said that, if you look at the actual share of the vote, our share of the vote has actually gone up. And we're in the perverse situation of having a higher share of the vote and less MPs. And I was actually quite tempted to say, you know, we shouldn't push the vote up for the Liberal Democrats up to 30%, because under this rather arcane voting system we have in this country, we probably end up with no MPs whatsoever. Because, you know, if you look at the way it's turned out, David Cameron thinks he can govern the country with 36% of the vote. You know, Labour only got 6% in front of the Liberal Democrats, and yet they've got around about 250 MPs in Parliament. We got 6% behind them, and we've only got about 60 MPs. So really, Labour got an extra nearly 200 seats based on an extra 6% of the vote. It is absolutely scandalous, and I think that is actually the message of this election, that people will no longer accept that the two old parties can just run this country on you know, on a minority of votes, and denying lots of other people in this country, not just the Liberal Democrats but other parties as well, an opportunity to share in the democratic process in this country. And I think that's going to be the big campaign in the next few months ahead.
Well, my big question for you, John, is I mean, you've been in the Liberal Democrat Party for a long, long time now. Why is it that Nick Clegg, it looks like he's going to be throwing his oar in with David Cameron, who's not at all interested in voting reform?
Well, I think Nick was actually quite fair when he actually said throughout the election campaign, because obviously it was a big issue, and we've actually ended up with what the polls did predict. The one thing they did predict correctly, unfortunately, they under-predicted our result, and I think we want our money back from the pollsters for that. But as far as the actual, you know, the result is concerned, they were pointing to a hung parliament all along, and Nick was asked every day about that, and what he said was, whoever got the most seats and the higher percent of the popular vote should have the opportunity first to actually form a government. And so he said this morning, on the media, that, you know, it was over to David Cameron, and David Cameron now, as I understand it, is actually making overtures, looking at cherry picking bits of the Liberal Democrat manifesto. We know that the Conservatives have actually not got many ideas for Britain, and we're rather flattered that they're actually taking some of our proposals and ideas and looking at maybe introducing them into legislation. But we are quite clear, we will only actually negotiate with any other party, and we're in a situation where nobody's got an overall control. It's just like on Brexit Council in the old days. You know, we have a programme, we have our own philosophy of doing things, and so long as somebody comes forward who's willing to actually, you know, look at those sensibly, then obviously, you know, we're happy to talk. But, you know, I think there's a long way to go yet, and there's going to be a lot of this toing and froing in the media, I'm afraid.
But is Nick Clegg just shooting himself in the foot if he's serious about voting reform? I mean, and obviously, if there was voting reform, the Liberal Democrats would massively increase their number of members of Parliament that they've got.
Well, I haven't seen anywhere that Nick Clegg isn't trying to get electoral reform. I mean, the four things that we actually campaigned for in the election are the four things we're actually talking to the other parties about. And it's about them. It's not just about the Liberal Democrats. The others have to meet us halfway. I mean, either Labour or the Conservatives or the other parties in Parliament. It's not just saying, oh, the Liberal Democrats have to negotiate and change their opinions or their views. You know, we put forward a prospectus to the electorate, four things about, you know, changing the tax system to make it fairer for people on very low incomes, on, you know, so they get, you know, on average £700 extra a year, you know, on a pupil premium, so our young people who are actually disadvantaged and not getting a good education actually get extra money to support them, you know, on a fair vote system and on green jobs. And so if anybody wants to talk to us about that, I'm sure Nick Clegg is happy to do that. As I said, it is actually something I won't be discussing with Nick Clegg or with David Cameron or with whoever replaces Gordon Brown, but certainly, you know, that's the negotiating position that we start from. But fair vote is absolutely crucial to that, because if we don't change the system in Parliament, we'll go on with minority governments on 36% of the vote thinking they have a right to rule. That has got to end. So many people are locked out of the system. 65% voted in the election last night, and that means 35% of people did not bother to vote at all, and there are probably reasons why that they do not feel, they probably feel that none of the above, thank you very much. We must engage those people more, and having a fair voting system will do that, in my opinion.
Martin Summers is joining us too, our old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, there's been a resounding result against what you and Labour were saying, which is that we've got to hold off with these cuts. It seems to me that most of the vote really is in favour of really bucking the trend that Gordon Brown has been doing so far, which is to say, well, we can't cut, we're going to have to leave it for another year.
Well, I think this kind of policy discussion is going to be the meat of the discussions between the party leaders. I think that if the Liberals go into a coalition with the Conservatives and bring forward swingeing cuts, they will live to regret such a thing. I don't believe that cuts is what the economy needs at the moment. I think that the Labour Party has basically been in disarray because we've been ideologically at odds with ourselves. Much of what's been done during the new Labour era is not in fact the sort of thing that Labour voters want to see. So we've been fighting an uphill battle against ourselves. I think it's going to be interesting to see which way the Liberals jump. What I'm pleased to see is that everybody's being calm about this. The markets seem to be relatively calm. Let's proceed and see what can be fixed up. But of course, I would personally love to see a coalition between the Liberals and the Labour Party, but I don't have influence at the top any more than John does. We'll just have to wait and see.
John, do you think that we might end up here with a bit of a dispute, as there was in the 1970s, between the leadership of the Liberal Democrats and the actual party faithful themselves, with the party faithful thinking, actually, we're leaning more towards Labour because we really want voting reform, and the leadership thinking otherwise?
No, I don't, and the reason I say this is because the party's grown up. I mean, in the 1970s, we had very few councillors, for example, and we had a very small parliamentary party that had not seen power for a very long time. You know, in Bristol, as you've already reported on your programme, you know, the Liberal Democrats actually strengthened their hold on Bristol, and that went from a situation where the council was in overall control. So we had to talk to other parties, the Labour Party and the Conservatives, about putting forward a programme for the council and a budget for the year. And there's a lot of experience now within the party, you know, across England. I mean, you know, we run Liverpool and Newcastle, Cardiff and these kind of places. A lot of these places were hung and have actually quite often strengthened towards Liberal Democrats, but we are used to negotiation. And of course, the same is true, and everybody forgot this, in Wales and in Scotland. It was Liberal Democrats actually who, you know, was involved in the Constitutional Convention conference that was up in Scotland, and helped, you know, with Labour to push through, you know, which has been probably the only main success I think of New Labour, was actually to devolve to the Parliament in Scotland, given real power. And so we've got a lot of experience of negotiations. So our membership is not going to be, you know, phased or worried. They're going to put a trust in the leadership of Nick Clegg, who so far I think hasn't put a foot wrong. And let's see what shakes out. There's going to be a lot of rumour, counterclaim, people saying you're going in with this one, you're going in with that one, with all the parties. You know, there are a lot of people in the Tory party who would like to do a deal with Gordon Brown and vice versa. It doesn't mean they may not in the end. Who absolutely knows? They did in Germany. The two parties in Germany actually, you know, the CDU and the SPD went together in the end. Everybody thought that was outrageous, but it did actually happen.
It's quite normal.
There you go. It's quite normal. If you get a programme, you can agree a programme, and that's what we have to do. We have to be grown up in this country. We have it in Wales. We haven't got it because you've got fixed terms. They can't just keep running to the country when they don't like the actual outcome. And so there's a lot of negotiations. We've got to be more grown up about this. And if parties can get together and agree a programme which commands actual majority democratic support of the people of this country, then we'll be better governed, and people will feel they actually have more of a stake, you know, in society, as opposed to these rather arrogant, you know, majority governments who run this country and have done it, you know, for generations, you know, take it or leave it attitude, I'm afraid. I think this is a very exciting but a very nerve-wracking period. But we're not going to blink. The Liberal Democrats will not blink at this election.
That was John Keeley, who's a Liberal Democrat, is Bristol City Councillor for Eastern. Now we're going to have a chat with Chris Windows, who's also in the studio here. He's a Conservative Bristol City Councillor for Henbury. Chris, why is it that David Cameron, even though he was 3 or 4 months ago so far ahead in the polls, has not managed to get an overall majority in the House of Commons last night?
I think, quite honestly, that there's a state of confusion that exists in politics in this country, and I think that this is the people saying, look, we're not happy with what's happening. and we're going to tell you we're not happy with what's happening. I mean, I've been listening to John talking there, and I suppose if I was a Liberal Democrat, which I most definitely am not, I would probably have said the sort of things he said. But I have to say that I remember an old Peter Sellers film. It was called The Mouse That Roared. And the Liberal Democrats at the moment remind me very much of that phrase.
But the thing is that the electorate has actually put them in the driving seat right now, depending on which way they go, whether they swing to the left or the right, really depends how the country's going to be moving forwards.
Well, I'm sure they like to think that they're actually holding the range of power, if you like. But I think we've got to wait a few days and see exactly what does happen, because we shouldn't forget that Gordon Brown is still in the equation and still in number 10 at the moment. I don't know what his new address will be, but I hope he'll let me know in due time so I can send him a card. But whilst we're looking at the successes locally of the Liberal Democrats, which they have had success locally, and it will mean to say that they've more accountable to the local citizens. At the same time, remember that we did get Charlotte Leslie into Bristol North West against very, very, very strong fight from a local Liberal Democrat contender. We also got Kingswood against a Labour politician who I have every respect for. Roger has always been, in my opinion,
this is Roger Berry, was the Labour MP.
He was the Labour MP, and also, of course, he was at one time the leader of the Labour Party on the old Avon County Council as well. But we took that one. We've done very well. The new seat,
why is it, do you
Stoke
think,
as well.
Why is it that you think that? Do you think that the Conservatives have done quite well nationally, but here locally, as we've just been hearing from John, have lost three of their seats on Bristol City Council? Now they're really shrinking quite drastically. Before long, they're going to be on about the same par as the Greens in Bristol, surely.
I think we might be a little bit more powerful than that. And we have, as John has said, we have a lot of experience on the council, a lot of experience in the Conservative Party on the council.
Are you going to give us a reason, though, why you think that the Conservatives lost so spectacularly, really, bucking the national general election trend on the city council?
Well, I wouldn't say one vote in Avonmouth was spectacular. I'd say it was a product of our system, which John doesn't like, but when it suits him, I'm sure that he's quite happy to go down that route.
Let's just hear from John. I mean, and then Martin. Why is it you think that the Conservatives have lost? I mean, there was. It's just to explain. A third of the Bristol City Council seats were up for grabs yesterday, and the count took place this morning. I think from about 9 a.m. to lunchtime and mid-afternoon, and we've only just heard the last result of those 23 seats, which are a third of the Bristol City Council seats. John, why is it you think then that the Conservatives have actually managed to lose three of their seats on the Bristol City Council?
Well, I mean, I can't really account for it generally. I suppose the Conservatives themselves can have to have a post-mortem and find out why that is. I mean, the only conclusion I can draw is that people in Bristol, I mean, the Liberal Democrats have come from nowhere in the last, 3 or 4 years. We had a situation where the council was actually balanced for a time. And I think people did feel actually there was a lot of horse trading, particularly between the Labour and the Conservatives, to keep the Liberal Democrats, who were the largest party, out of office. And once the public decided to give us a majority, and they gave us it last year, and they've seen what we've been able to do, I think this is a vote of confidence in the Liberal Democrats to say, yeah, we actually like, you know, it was in the middle of a big recession, and lots of people have lost their jobs, lots of services have been cut. And if you look at Tory councils around Bristol, you know, in North Somerset and other places, what they're doing actually is they're cutting the council tax to give people a rebate, at the same time as closing libraries and pensioners' homes and all the rest of it. And I think people are kind of like a bit nervous. And I suspect that's the reason why David Cameron hasn't actually enjoyed a majority, because a lot of people remember that when Mrs. Thatcher was in office, actually how cold-hearted they were to people who were actually unemployed, and they closed mines and steel works and all the rest. It didn't seem to care very much for ordinary people in this country. And when you're in a recession and people are either on short-term working, on low incomes, or fear of losing their jobs or their homes, they don't really want the Conservatives to be overall in charge of the benefit system. And I think that's probably why David Cameron, because he hasn't sealed that deal, the public were nervous about that. And I think the same thing goes on Bristol City Council. They know that overall the Liberal Democrats are a progressive left-to-centre party, that we do try our best to care for people. We don't want to make people redundant. We don't want to cut services. And we've absolutely
you know, actually pulled every sinew we can to protect Bristol from the worst excesses of this, unfortunately, Gordon Brown's recession. I mean, I think that's what they've done, is they've given us their trust. They don't trust the Conservatives, you know, to be involved in Bristol City Council. You know, in that sense, we've actually consolidated our grip on the council. That's the only conclusion I can draw. I can't draw another one, I'm afraid.
Martin, what were your thoughts about the Conservatives' low showing on the Bristol City Council
To be honest with you, I don't think we should read too much into it, Tony. I think the Conservatives have had a pretty good night, but on the whole, not good enough to form a government, but for the reasons that John's just explained, because they haven't sealed the deal, certainly with the bottom income half of the electorate. And that's why that's why they're stalled where they are. I think that I've always believed in changing the electoral system, because then we could have a proper spread of opinions and a proper discussion. Because of course the Labour Party, in my view, should be putting forward much more bold policies for tackling the crisis, which is not just fiddling while Rome burns. But we've got to actually develop that in a situation where we don't have to form a majority for that view in one go, so that we can talk about it in a serious way. And I hope that as we go forward, these things will become clear. And coming back to what John was saying earlier about grand coalitions, I mean, that is normal in places like Switzerland, Austria and Germany. Labour-Conservative coalitions do rule, often with Liberal Democrat support. And that's what you can do sometimes in a democratic system, provided you've got agreement about the general policy. And I think that's going to be the difficult one, because I don't believe in cutting public expenditure at this moment, or at all, in fact. I know that's not official Labour Party policy, but I think that cutting public expenditure in a recession like this, as we did in the 80s, is just stupidity.
But it looks
if whoever forms the government does it, the economy will go immediately into a tailspin, and people will realise why it was such a stupid idea. I say no, don't do it.
Now, John, for the Lib Dems, and Chris, for the Conservatives, haven't you just both come from the Bristol City Council House? John, maybe you could just tell us what was going on there, because I hear that the last announcement that was made is the Avonmouth, and there actually was only, after how many recounts, there was only one vote in it at Avonmouth, and Spud Murphy, the Conservative councillor, who had been Conservative councillor there, has now lost his seat to Doug Naismith, who was the Bristol North West MP.
Well, yeah, Doug Naismith has gone up in the world, hasn't he? Because he was an MP for a number of years, and now he's a Bristol City Councillor, so that has to be a step forward. And I think me and Chris do agree, and I mean, don't take this as being a coalition or anything, but we do agree that the whole process to do with the election has been an absolute shambles. There is an inquiry being undertaken by the Electoral Commission, but quite frankly, a lot of us are absolutely appalled at the shambles, the loss of postal votes, you know, parliamentary candidates appearing on ballot papers as the local candidate for a local ward, for example. In Bristol West, we actually had postal votes delivered for Bristol East elections, electorate. The whole thing, it was a sorry mess.
Your experience in politics, is this unprecedented?
Well, I've never come across anything in my entire life. I mean, I'm involved in lots of actual elections, not just here in Bristol, you know, across the country, and I've never actually witnessed anything quite like it. And I wouldn't mind if it wasn't for the fact that we have elections by thirds in Bristol, so we actually ought to be very slick at it. And there we have, yet again, you know, a complete mess. And today, when people were very, very tired, a lot of, people, activists from all the parties had been up all night, you know, counting votes for a general election campaign, and some of them very, very tired, and then having to come down in the morning and sit through a teeth-grinding process that went on, you know, terminally for hours and hours and hours. And then you had the Avonmouth result, which was the biggest farce of all. They lost about 50 postal votes. Then all of a sudden, magically, they found them. I don't know, were they behind a bush? Who knows? And the vote was then tied. And, there was talk about tossing a coin. And I understand Spud Murphy said he had a two-headed coin in his pocket. I think Spud was probably a bit tongue-in-cheek. knowing Spud well. But in the end, they found that one vote in Doug Naismith's favour. But it actually hasn't done the City Council, I'm afraid, any good, and our electoral services people any good at all. And I think there's going to be a big inquiry, and I hope all parties, and I'm sure Chris and I will be asking very serious questions about the whole way this has been conducted. It's been appalling.
Well, I find myself in the
very unusual position of having to agree completely with what John has said, and it's not something that sort of happens every day, thank goodness. But I have to say I agree with him totally. It's been a complete farce. I find myself somewhat embarrassed to be a councillor on a body which cannot organise an election, which they should be able to do. As John has said, we elect by thirds. They've got plenty of experience. Everybody was totally shattered. Everybody, including the poor clerks that were there to do the counting, they were hanging as well. It's a recipe for mistakes. We're all human beings, and when we're very, very tired, it's easy to make mistakes.
Can you just tell us what the problems in the actual election process that you saw that you thought were a problem?
Well, one of the first things that springs to mind is the fact that the general election count for Bristol North West was supposed to take place in the Henry Leisure Centre, roughly in the middle of the North West constituency. At the 11th hour, it was decided that for health and safety reasons, they could not hold the actual election count there, and okay. It had to be moved.
Okay, so who made that decision? It sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I wouldn't like to put a name to it because I could get into a lot of trouble. I've got my own suspicions. I'm sure John has as well.
So, I mean, it must ultimately come down to the returning officer. Isn't that the person who's supposed to be responsible and where the buck stops with these elections?
Yes, it is. It's down to the returning officer.
So the actual count then took place, what are you saying, actually outside the constituency?
Outside the constituency. It meant to say that all the boxes had to be taken from the north of the city, across the river to the south of the city, basically, and it was held in Bristol South constituency. Absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I mean, one of the things, because we were covering it live here on BCFM, on that count, one of the reporters, I think it was Andrew Parsonage, was reporting into us around about 3 o'clock in the morning, saying that actually some of the postal votes still hadn't turned up at the count. Now, you would have thought that when the ballot boxes turn up from the ordinary paper votes that are taking place during the day, the postal votes should be there waiting, shouldn't they?
One would have thought so. I think it comes down to the checking of the postal votes. There doesn't seem to be any joined up thinking there. I think it's something that all councillors are going to have to demand an explanation as soon as possible.
Now, I'm going to ask you, John, because you are part of the ruling group on Bristol City Council, and you are actually ultimately responsible for appointing the returning officer and making sure this process works.
I thought we might come into this eventually. Thank you for that, yeah. We only just tightened our grip today, you know. So, yeah, we didn't know whether we'd be in overall control, you're looking at the figures. So, no, I'm not hiding away from it. Yes, we do have to take ultimate responsibility in the end. If you want to take power and actually exercise that power on behalf of the people, then you have to accept on occasions that things go wrong and you must learn from those things. You know, we employ officers, professional officers, to do a job, you know, on behalf of the council. The process to do with electoral services is actually completely independent of the council, really, because it has to be. You can't actually have interference, you know, from the politicians, otherwise obviously people wouldn't think it was fair and free. But that doesn't, I'm not hiding from the fact that, you know, there is going to be a huge debate, and I'm using that word very politely, it'd probably be a lot worse than that, to come in the next couple of weeks or so. And if we're not satisfied with the answers we get, then, as I said, you know, some of us will be expecting a lot more to happen. Because the Electoral Commission has been called in. It was called in straight away. You know, the chief executive took that decision without actually, you know, a second thought. So that's already happened. And so we'll look at the report we get from the Electoral Commission, and whatever recommendations they come up with, we will actually implement. But no, I would apologise to people. I think it's an absolute disgrace, a farce, and a very sorry saga. It does not put Bristol in a very good light.
Well, I mean, we've done fared better here than some other cities. Apparently, Manchester, Liverpool, Newcastle, Sheffield, East London and Surrey have all had situations where people actually were queuing up at 10 o'clock still and actually weren't able to cast their vote in other parts of the country. Now, certainly in my experience, this is unprecedented. Martin, what are your thoughts about this whole process?
Well, what's the first striking thing is that the returning officers in different constituencies did not pursue the same policy. So in some places, people were allowed in to vote after 10 o'clock once they'd queued up, and in other places, they were not. I mean, obviously, everything has to be done by the rules, and people are supposed to be there by 10 o'clock. But to be honest with you, when they have elections in South Africa or Iraq, if people are still queuing up outside the polling station, especially if they're being threatened with car bombs or whatever, you don't say go home. You say we'll wait and we will see to you. And that's what happened in America during the election of Obama as well. So let's hope that all of these irregularities absolutely need to be ironed out within Bristol or anywhere else if we're going to have confidence in the system. But let's hope that the irregularities don't change the politics of the situation too dramatically, so that we're not going to get fussed about arguing about all these very important details, but they are details. We've got to talk about policy because we've got an economic crisis.
Well, I know you want to talk about policy, Martin, but ultimately there's no point in all this unless we've got a free and fair election. And actually, Labour have been in charge of this election, ultimately. This is an election which has taken place under a Labour government. Why is it, you think, that we've had all these unprecedented, shall we say, slip-ups in the actual functioning of the election?
Well, the election is organised at local level by local councils, and that's how it's done. I mean, and if insofar as we or our party has been responsible for any mess, then responsibility must be taken. I mean, obviously, the obvious point to bring up here is Kerry McCarthy's gaffe of twittering up the postal results before the election was actually run, which is illegal. And, you know, I mean, so we've got to put our hands up there and say, well, that was silly. Beyond silly, it was illegal. And, you know, all of these things have to be dealt with. But let's not get obsessed with all of this, because we've got what really matters, and what I was saying earlier, the markets seem to be stable for now. If this wrangling turns bitter in the middle of next week, we'll have to see what George Soros and the hedge fund speculators do with the pound. That's what people have got to start thinking about. That's what we've got to focus on.
Well, the reason I'm talking about the process, maybe more than you would like, Martin, is because we're trying constantly to engage more people to actually turn out and vote. This is not going to help that, is it?
No, it's not.
I think the other thing that needs to be, you know, really thought about, and this is all part about, you know, modernising our democracy, which is something obviously the Liberal Democrats fought this election on, and that is really, you know, why is it that people vote on a Thursday? I mean, I've never worked that one out. I mean, quite frankly, most people are at work, so you're getting a bottleneck in the evening when people are coming home. That's where the problem is. If you allowed people to vote over a longer period, maybe over a weekend, as they do in France in the presidential elections, for example, they vote over a couple of weekends, you know, you get round this problem. You know, which why we seem to be stuck in a time warp in this country all the time. I mean, you know, everything in terms of communication has moved on. People expect things much more instantly, you know, today than ever did. But it seems, you know, we've got a Victorian Parliament with a Victorian voting system, and we have a Victorian electoral system to run alongside it. We must actually grasp the nettle. We have an opportunity now with a Parliament that has, you know, nobody overall in control of it. All the parties, it's something I'm sure we could all agree on, actually, in Parliament. All the parliamentarians could agree on it, that we must modernise the whole voting system. And one thing we should be doing is moving away from Thursdays. It's an absolute farcical, you know, situation. I mean, I have to take a day off work, for example, to do it. And that, I mean, I enjoy doing it. It's something, you know, it's in my DNA, if you like. For a lot of other people, they're at work all day, they're tired, they come home at 6, 7 o'clock at night, somebody knocking the door, and oh, will I go down or whatever? And it's better to do it over a weekend, give them much more choice.
Well, apparently, I was reading this just the other day in the Daily Mirror, that the reason that these elections take place on Thursday is because traditionally payday, when you got your little pay slip, was on a Friday, and they found that there were less people who would be drunk on a Thursday, and so people would be more likely to vote on a Thursday. The other thing, though, you were saying there about maybe having elections that take place over maybe several days, then you've got another problem, haven't you, raising its ugly head, and that is the possibility of interfering with the ballot boxes between when the vote starts and when the count takes place.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's something that we'll obviously have to look at.
I mean, surely people want the result as quickly as possible for actually naturally sensible reasons, and that is that you don't want ballot boxes lying around with people having the opportunity to interfere with them.
Well, it doesn't seem to actually, you know, be a problem in France. And I think if you listen to the people who were interviewed on the radio this morning, when I listened to the radio this morning, who didn't get their vote at all, and now have to wait another 5 years, unless, of course, David Cameron, because he can't, you know, get his way, goes to the country in 3 months' time or whatever, who really knows what's going to happen. But, you know, ultimately, you know, it's not very good in a democracy that people went down to vote last night and were locked out and couldn't vote. Potentially, as I said, they might have to wait another 4 or 5 years to exercise their democratic right. And I think as they're paying taxes and all the rest of it, I think it's actually quite appalling that we couldn't even organise that for them. So we do need to look at alternatives. Yes, there are problems with any system, but they do have, you know, weekend voting in lots of other countries. I'm sure we can learn
learn the lessons for how they do it to make sure that the obviously the ballot boxes, you know, are secure. And we might get away from the situation where we've got an election on a Thursday night in Bristol and we've lost half the ballot papers for Avonmouth ward, which didn't seem to help very much.
Yeah, I don't think, quite honestly, we have to look as far as France in discussing this problem, because if we go back to June last year when we had the Euro elections, we had the vote on the Thursday, but the boxes were locked up until the Sunday, and the count took place on the Sunday. And I was at that count, and I have to say it was almost as bad an experience as it was last night. But then it was held at Bristol South at the football ground, so perhaps that's going to be precise what sort of will happen in the future. But no, if they can lose something overnight, then they can lose it over a weekend or a week, a month or whatever. So yeah, I do agree that we should perhaps have a jolly good look at the day that we use for voting. And yeah, let's look across at the continent. They do vote on Sundays. I've got family in Switzerland, and quite frankly, they seem at some times to be going to the polls every Sunday. I wouldn't advocate that, but...
They have a lot of referendums.
They like to decide things properly, I think.
Okay, so Chris, let me just stay with you for a moment, because I want to ask you why it is you think that your leader David Cameron is really sticking out for because if he's got the largest vote, he should have the first bite of the cherry. I mean essentially we've got a tradition here where the government just carries on if it can. I think that's, isn't that sensible? Because it's just it's a climate of stability, and that's surely what we need right now.
Well, quite frankly, if you're describing what's happened over the last 10 years of stability, I'm frankly shocked at that. It's been anything but stable. We've had job losses. I know there's been a global recession, but it's been a very useful hook for Gordon to hang his hat on. And look what we were being told by Gordon. No more boom and bust. He was telling the truth there. No more boom, just bust. And I'm sure that's been said all around the country. And he's not totally responsible for it, because he was saving the world at the same time. So you can't blame him totally. But he's got to take the lion's share of the blame for it. And as far as David Cameron wanting to push the fact that he should be in charge of the country from now on, it's because, quite frankly, he believes that, and there's a majority of people in this country that believe that. Look at the seats we've got. We've got more seats than anybody else, and I know John's not going to agree with this, but secretly he knows it's true. And I know he's got a little smile on his face now for listeners that can't see it, but I can tell you he's got a benign smile upon his face now, which is most unusual. Check the council webcam. But all I can say is that he's doing what he thinks is right. He cares about people. He cares about the country, and he speaks very strongly about it. And I can't wait for him to get his hands on the tiller and start putting things right. And I'm sure the rest of the country can't either.
But surely the country has decided they don't want him alone with his hands on the tiller. They want him to come to an agreement with one of the other parties.
They haven't quite seen the light yet, but I think it's coming.
Okay. John, if you were David Cameron, if you were Nick Clegg, which way would you personally be leaning? Would you be leaning towards Mr. Cameron or Mr. Brown right now?
I wouldn't be leaning towards either of them. I mean, essentially, what I would be doing is actually, putting forward the policies that would actually make this a much more liberal country. And so I'd be taking the things out of our manifesto, and I would be talking to the other parties to see if I could get those implemented into a Queen's speech. I'm not bothered about, you know, who runs the country and who sits in the JAG and whatever. I know David Cameron and George Osborne love all that, because the Tories actually love running things. They love having their nameplates over the door and feeling important. But in the end, it's about trying to do something that helps ordinary people, you know, in their lives, helps the environment and helps the economy. And, if I was Nick Clegg, I'd be saying these are the issues that I want to go into this Queen's speech. And if any party was willing to actually put those forward, actually in a Queen's speech, I think I would be a very happy Nick Clegg. I certainly wouldn't be a very happy Nick Clegg if I was actually involved in coalition talks with either of these two parties. Sorry, I'm moving around the table here at the moment, in the studio. There we go. because neither of them have really been very progressive. It's all very fine making excuses for Gordon Brown. They've had 13 years in office. We've been involved in, you know, two wars. You know, the gap between the rich and the poor has got wider. You know, on environmental issues, they're very, very weak. And they've actually destroyed our civil liberties. And I'm sorry, as a Liberal, I'm actually not very happy with that record. Having said that, David Cameron said nothing apart from the fact that he was the change, but he hasn't told us what that change is. He says he's the progress in the future. Well, he's now got 48 hours probably to prove it, and if he can, well, fair enough, but I very much doubt it.
This is Chris Windows, who's a Conservative MP on Bristol City Council. Chris, what have you got to say to that?
No, I'm not an MP. I decided to go for the top.
Oh, right, sorry, councillor. All right. Sorry about that.
Well, that's all right. It's understandable.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's some pretty swinging criticisms of your boss there.
Yeah, well, it's quite a surprise coming from John. I mean, he's not noted for criticising the other parties. I just rest on what I've said. I mean, John is going to say those sort of things because Liberal Democrats for so long now have been able to promise all sorts of things that they knew darn well they weren't ever going to be called upon to deliver because they weren't going to be in power. So if you haven't got to come up with the goods, you can promise anything. We've put our necks on the line. You know, David Cameron has put his neck on the line and said, "I will put the country right." Well, he's going to have to answer to the country if he can't do that, but I believe he can, and the majority of people in the country believe he can. The ones that have voted for him prove that. And yes,
well, it's not quite a majority, is it? It's the largest minority.
Okay, the largest minority. But if you want to go down the road, you can criticise the fact that whatever happens, as far as percentages are concerned, the Labour Party will always have far more parliamentary seats than they should be entitled to according to their percentage of the vote. Yeah, we've got to change the system. I don't think that we're going to change it quite the way that John would like to see it changed and his party would like to see it changed, but I do believe that we do have to have a change in our voting system.
Okay, that's interesting to hear coming from you. Now, John, what about any changes? You think we're likely to see any changes on the Cabinet on Bristol City Council after this election?
Well, there's a meeting tomorrow, obviously, of the council group where we actually elect officers to serve the council group, and on Monday there will actually be obviously an election for cabinet and scrutiny roles.
So it'll be a kind of reshuffle. Is that the way it works?
Not necessarily. I mean, we're a democratic party, so anybody can put their name forward.
So you don't have a president telling you right now you're in this job. It's not like the cabinet in Westminster works.
Well, in a sense, I suppose it might well be. I mean, what actually happens under Liberal Democrat standing orders on Bristol City Council is anybody can put their name forward. Any councillor in the group put their name forward to be in the cabinet, and so long as a majority of people, and it's done by PR, by the way,
proportional representation,
of course, first, second, third, and fourth, which we have in Scotland and in Wales and for European elections, but David Cameron doesn't want for Westminster, but they have to do things differently.
Not all his party members seem to agree.
Exactly, but you know, anyway, so people put their names forward to go in the cabinet on a PR system. If they get over 50% of the vote, blah blah blah, they get into the cabinet. Barbara Jank, who is the leader of the Liberal Democrats on Bristol Council, she then talks to people about allocating them with a post and a role, and that's the way it works. So she does have the final say over which portfolio they have in a cabinet, but the membership itself decide who goes into that cabinet, and I think that's a really wonderful democratic system, much better than what they have in Westminster.
So how is Barbara herself elected, or is she...
She's elected by the whole membership. She's up for re-election tomorrow. There's an annual meeting. The leader, the deputy leader, the whip, and the chair and the treasurer all have to stand for re-election. It's the same in every party, I'm sure. And so Barbara puts her name forward tomorrow. There's obviously a vote on that, and if she commands the majority of Liberal Democrats on Bristol City Council, she then becomes the leader of the group and obviously de facto leader of the council, and then obviously other officers. So it's very, very democratic. You know, there's no right to rule or anything like that at all. And other members have said anybody can put their name forward, they can nominate themselves for any post within the party, and other colleagues can say, yes, I think that person will be fantastic for that, and if you get a majority, they're home and dry.
Now, what about you? You were talking about some of these voting irregularities earlier on, because I think for me that is, I find that really concerning, especially since we're not having any massive changes going to go on Bristol City Council, maybe a few jobs shuffled around. But this, in my experience, is unprecedented to have so many problems, you know, really quite serious problems, which, you know, in places like Avonmouth, which has only been decided on one vote, even just a few votes going astray, or maybe the wrong ballot papers being given to people, makes all the difference, doesn't it? What are the anomalies that you've seen in this particular election?
Well, I think the main anomaly was actually where they sent the postal vote ballot papers out in Eastern and Lawrence Hill wards for Bristol East for that election, where of course we're in Bristol West. So all those voters then had to be written to by the council to say, you know, if you voted already, your vote won't count. We're sending a new ballot paper. That was an absolute disaster. And so people were getting their ballot papers in towards the end of that week. So they nearly had a whole week without their ballot papers. And some people were nervous. There was a bank holiday on the Monday, so there was no post. So people were wondering, were they going to get their ballot papers back in time? And so, you know, that was probably the worst one. I was told, I have no evidence for this, but I was told this, the parliamentary candidate in Bristol East's name appeared as the local candidate in Brislington East. So they got Bristol East and Brislington East mixed up. And it's kind of funny that the returning officer today, when she was announcing the Brislington East result, actually said Bristol East and not Brislington East. So they've obviously got a mindset problem between those two places. I think me and Chris would know the difference between Bristol East and Brislington East. You know,
are these people from Bristol, the people who are in charge of these elections?
I think probably from Mars, the way it is.
Where it's gone so far, or even further afield. I think John will agree on that.
Yeah, I think me and Chris, as I said, I don't think there's any disagreement over that.
So how does the process work anyway, with the electoral, calling in the electoral commission? How does that process work? Have you any experience
of that? No, I've no experience whatsoever. I mean, I did actually listen to the chief executive of the electoral commission on the radio this morning, defending, you know, the shambles of people queuing up outside and then the doors closing on them, and having waited from 8:30 at night until 10 o'clock and then told you can't vote.
Defending it?
Well, she was defending the fact that it was. She was saying, "Well, they can't vote after unless they're inside the polling station and give a ballot paper. They can't vote, you know." So, not exactly very much comfort to somebody to be waiting outside, you know, and may not get a chance to vote again for another few years, possibly. But anyway, she's obviously going to be rather busy over the next few weeks because she's got plenty of these running up and down the country. But as far as Mr. concerned, I assume what they do is they will come in, they will look at all the, all the issues that have been raised and have been raised by all the parties, there's no doubt. And then they will actually produce a report which recommendations, and I would assume that's the way these things always tend to work, and then everybody actually all accepts the reports and the recommendations at full council, and it's carried out. There is no debate about this. It is absolutely vitally important that people have confidence in the voting system, that it's fair and free, and it takes place in a proper conducted manner, and we will do everything, all parties I'm sure will do everything we can to make sure that does happen in the future.
Now, the fiasco in Ukraine is what we're going to be having a look at now. Hopefully, nothing quite so bad as that happening in Bristol City Council or at Westminster. And we're joined, I'm very happy to say, by Marina Boris, who's back from her trip to Ukraine. Hi, Marina, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Again.
Hello.
Nice to have you back. Now, you spent April in Ukraine, 2 months after February's presidential election, which changed Orange Ukraine to the blue. What's different? And we're always interested in Ukraine, because this is the biggest country in Europe, and also it's a kind of test case. Which way is Ukraine going to go? Is it going to go be friendly to Moscow and Vladimir Putin, or is it going to be friendly to the European Union and the United States?
I knew Ukraine orange government, and I now had an experience of Ukraine, this new leadership. Ukraine has been changed to a pro-Russian direction of strategic alliance. Relation between Kiev and Moscow had taken a 180-degree turn since Viktor Yanukovych became president. I visited the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, the second largest city, Kharkov. The Ukraine's president Yanukovych met this Russia leader, Dmitry Medvedev, and the Crimea. Many former leaders who were sacked by orange government are back in power. Ukraine has signed the Black Sea Fleet Agreement with Russia, which the orange government refused to endorse. It has been announced that Russian and Belarusian forces will join to the country's 9 May Victory Day parade. The first time foreign troops will have marched in the event since Ukraine became independent 9 years ago. This sensitive day for the people and parade is being used for political advantage, improving the alliance with Russia. Interest in NATO alliance appears to be blocked. Ukraine are preparing also for Euro 2012. Many cities have new modern Euro standard stadium. Also in Kiev and Kharkov, I have seen building a new terminals in the airport. Ukrainian media is free and can voice anti-governmental opinion. Many publications openly joke that Yanukovych is a Russian servant. The people are friendly, positive, open and hope for the better future.
But many people will have seen the pictures of the eggs and smoke bombs. Are these, and that is in the Ukrainian Parliament, are these the opposition's weapons in the Ukrainian Parliament?
Yes. 21st of April in Kharkov, near Ukraine's borders with Russia, President Yanukovych met this Russia leader, Dmitry Medvedev, to agree the Navy-based deal in exchange for a 30% cut in the price of Russia gas to Ukraine, a boon to Kiev's struggling economy. This deal allowed the Russian Navy to extend its stay in Ukrainian Black Sea port until 2042. Experts and opposition criticize this deal. Ukrainian nationalists, led by the former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko and former President Viktor Yushchenko, they see the base as a betrayal of Ukraine's national interest and the agreement as against the country's constitution. They wanted to remove it when the existing lease runs out in 2017. If society today turns a blind eye to the Kharkov agreement, it is possible that it will be the biggest loss to our sovereignty and independence, former Ukraine President Yushchenko said. But Parliament ratified the lease extension by 236 votes, 10 more than the minimum required to hold eggs and smoke bombs inside Ukraine's parliament from opposition. After this contract, Ukraine can have $12 billion from the World Bank Organization to stabilize the economy.
So, now Ukraine has got cut price gas from the Russians. Does Moscow use energy politics as a tool of strategic influence?
Not only opposition. Some of Yanukovych's own governmental colleagues doubt that this was the right course of action. They insist that the alternatives should have been better evaluated and imply that this deal was hasty. I have wrote this serious Ukraine magazine. Here, this magazine. I have a lot of this magazine. The Yanukovych is depicted as a cartoon Russian sailor saluting a logo, "Serve the Russian people." The newly elected Yanukovych wants to significantly improve ties with his former Soviet master. He says the Black Sea Fleet in Crimea does not endanger Ukraine's national interest and enhanced European security. Also, he plans to be a president for 10 years, two terms, and now he has more control over future resources. Also, the Black Sea Fleet agreement is a very good outcome for the oligarchs and owners of chemical factories and smelters who financially supported Yanukovych's election in February 2010. Opponents of the Black Sea deal says that by hosting the fleet, Ukraine could be dragged into future Moscow conflict with other powers. The Russians sent warships to support Russian military action against Ukraine's then ally, the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, during Russia's brief war there in August 2008.
So, what is the historical situation with the Russian fleet in Sevastopol?
The Russian fleet has been based in Sevastopol since the time of Catherine the Great in the 18th century. But under an accord, the Ukraine gained independence following the breakup of the Soviet Union. The fleet would have had to leave in 2017. The Russian fleet in Sevastopol comprised about 16,200 personnel, a rocket cruiser, a large destroyer, and about 40 other vessels, including submarines, laden craft, small destroyers, and support ships. Proponents point out that the Crimea was part of Russian until then Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine in the 1950s. The region retains a strong Russian learning population.
Now, we've all heard about the economic crisis here in Britain, and things getting even worse in Spain, Italy and Portugal, and we've seen the riots on the streets of Athens in Greece over the last couple of weeks, certainly the last 3 or 4 days. How about the social conditions in Ukraine?
46 million Ukrainians still have a deep economical crisis. 2 million unemployed, of 20.3 million of working age. Every producing worker has one pensioner and one civil servant to support. In 2008, the average monthly income per citizen was around $330, but this is distributed evenly. Pensioners are very much less than this. A minor operation can cost upwards about $1,000. For many, they can only afford to die. The people are generally dissatisfied with this medical care. Ukraine has 31 doctors for every 10,000 people. The World Health Organization standard is 13 doctors for 10,000 people. Every service can only be obtained on payment or gratuity. Ukrainians like football very much, the arts and theaters, and also popular. Ukrainians prefer coffee to tea. Vodka consumption is the third highest in the world after Russian and United States, and average life expectancy only 68. Also, Ukraine have many political parties and an active opposition. The country now is preparing the celebration of the 65th anniversary of the victory in the Second Great War and financially rewarding the remaining veterans.
Marina Morris, thank you very much for that report on the Ukraine. It's lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
Now, back to our two guests. It's John Keeley, who's Liberal Democrat councillor for Easton, and also Chris Windows, who's Conservative Bristol City councillor for Henbury. Now, I'm going to ask you two to put your headphones on and have a listen to this report, because we're doing a couple of news stories, and we're going to hear, first of all, from the Drive Time reporter, Richard Cowley. Now, Richard Cowley was at two events this week. Firstly, on bank holiday, Cheltenham Road was closed to traffic near Stokes Cross as police tried to arrest a man who was up on top of a building. And as I said, Richard Cowley was there.
I think it's a complete overreaction on the police's behalf. You've got a guy there in riot gear, been absolutely owned by him. I can't remember the guy's name, but been absolutely owned. You've got two fire engines, which are not needed, because we've got a guy in riot gear, so they're wasting the fire engine's times as well.
A misuse of taxpayers' money as usual, an overreaction. We've just seen, as you said, a riot policeman getting into the building now, and he's armed with a pistol as well. How many people do you think are actually in the building?
It's just one man at the top, and now they turned up with two fire engines to get him off the roof.
I'm not actually squatting, but I'm actually using a disused building up in Clifton at the cathedral, and that's with the agreement of the developers. So I have a connection with Artspace Lifespace, who are in the old police station, the old Bridewell, and the old fire station. Again, they're there at the agreement of the developers. So you can build up a relationship with a developer with an unused building and use it temporarily, which I think is advantages to both parties. So at the cathedral up in Clifton, we tend to be able to keep children out because it is actually a dangerous building, so there's a certain amount of security. We stop the fly tipping. We get something out of it because we're able to use the space to store and as a workshop.
Now, that was a short report there from Richard Cowley, who was down on Monday on Cheltenham Road. Now, I'm quite surprised. This is the second time in a couple of months we've had Cheltenham Road completely closed off to traffic because there's been something going on with a squatter. In this case, it was someone the police were trying to arrest who was actually stood on the top of the roof. Now, is it really wise for the police to try and arrest someone who stood on the roof, top of the roof, John?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances. I wasn't quite clear, you know, from the report. It doesn't really sort of like highlight what the actual issue is.
Well, I think the guy was there was a warrant out for his arrest, and the police tried to arrest the guy, but then he managed to get up onto the very top of the roof. Now, from that situation, it's kind of an impasse, isn't it? What the police have decided to do is just literally back off for a few days or weeks and just wait for a safer opportunity to arrest him.
They did wait, did they, for a couple of weeks?
They've now said they're going to wait for a safe opportunity to arrest him. They're not going to attempt to arrest him on the top of the roof. But it seems surely they could have made that decision a little bit earlier rather than close Cheltenham Road off for most of the afternoon.
Well, I think, these are, you know, obviously decisions that have to be made operationally at the time. I mean, we're not there, so we don't really know. I mean, we had a situation, if you recall, probably a couple of weeks ago, where somebody was actually hanging over the footbridge over the M32 bike between St. Werburgh's and Easton, and they did close the road, the M32, which is very inconvenient for a lot of people, commuters and all the rest of it. But, you know, really, if you're employing professionals, in a sense, to do a job, then they've got to be able to kind of assess the situation, decide what they think. Sometimes they may get it wrong. I don't know the circumstances well enough in this case.
Okay, Chris.
I I think I agree with
you.
Give
you the last word on this one.
I mean, we can't judge the situation. The police commander who has the has to take the responsibility must actually take the decision at the time. The only thing I would say is that more recent health and safety has brought all sorts of changes into the way we run our lives, and not all of them good.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guests, that is Liberal Democrat Councillor for Easton, John Keeley, and Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows. And I would imagine that the story about the various mistakes and inability for people to vote, or a possible loss of voting papers around Bristol, we're not going to have heard the last of that tonight. Okay, so after the news, just after incredible claims were made about the discovery of Noah's Ark in eastern Turkey, we revisit the Bible story of Noah and the flood. Farmer and founder of Noah's Ark Zoo Farm, Anthony Bush, is here to explain his views on creation and evolution. And Billy Quain is here with his credit crunch beating What's On Guide. Join us after the news.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.